The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are
main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Great to be here and lots to talk about today, so let's jump right in. For those of you who would like to call our program today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Those of you preferring email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, thespaceshow.com, so do check it out. We have a very detailed newsletter in the middle of the page. You can't miss it, and that's uploaded fresh each week after the Sunday Space Show program, and then if we need to modify or change the schedule or any of the guests or anything like that during the week, we modify the website newsletter first. So if you want to stay current on our programming, do check it from time to time. Also, the website newsletter is the only place where we have a future events section for the Space Show. So if you want to see who the guests are coming up over the next week or 2 weeks or month or so, do go to the website newsletter and just scroll down to future attractions. You can also subscribe to our very short email newsletter from the website newsletter, and that goes out early Monday morning, California time. Guaranteed not to clutter up your inbox, just one or two lines about the week's programming. So do check it out. And do remember that everything we do is archived on our blog as well as our website. The blog is http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com, where you can also post comments for the guest as well as other listeners. But you can easily download these shows, or you can listen right off of our website or right off of the link on the blog. There is a store on our website. Look in the upper left-hand corner. It says Space Show Gear. There are social media buttons there, and then there's a guest search tool next to the social media buttons. This lists all of our shows in chronological order, going back to 2001. The newest shows are on top, and here you can do global searches for your favorite term, like space tourism, or your favorite guest. And you'll pick up all of the shows by date that dealt with that subject or where that person was a guest on the show. And then you can pull those shows up on the Space Show search engine on our main page when you go back to thespaceshow.com. The most important button to me is the Support the Space Show button, because remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do support us, and that keeps us going. And we thank you very much for that support. Remember that you get a tax deduction on the federal side if you're paying U.S. federal taxes. The same is true for those of you who pay California taxes. We do have our annual campaign coming up. It starts right after Thanksgiving, so please look for that. And again, we appreciate your support. If you want to see what OneGiantLeapFoundation.org is all about, go to that website, because that is our parent. And then one more thing. Remember that we are partially sponsored and brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. And Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. You can get much more information from them by visiting their own website, www.swfound.org. And they also sponsor our webinar series. And that brings us to today's program, and I'm very happy to introduce to all of you Gerald Driggers. He is a retired, successful aerospace engineer, and he now writes science fiction for fun and profit. He was prominent in the studies of space colonization and space industrialization with Dr. O'Neill in the 70s. He later enjoyed success in such diverse engineering areas as air pollution control, missile defense, and maritime security. He got his bachelor's and master's degree in aerospace engineering from Auburn University. He served as an officer in the Air Force, working on satellite launch vehicles, and in the Alabama Air National Guard as a battlefield civil engineer. He's published over 35 technical papers with general interest articles and contributed to 3 books on the technical subjects. One of his greatest privileges was to receive a prestigious national award presented by Sir Arthur Clarke. Gerald also embraced the dreams of Dr. von Braun and his team at an early age, and he was privileged to meet and work with many of them. He sought to contribute to the realization of their dream until it became obvious that the space leadership and general populace of the United States did not share those dreams. He has a series of books, The Earth Mars Chronicles, that bring that dream to life with new vigor. He and his wife were the first U.S. sponsors for the Mars One project. And the Earth Mars Chronicles, you can actually go there on the website. The URL is earth-mars.com, and you will get to Earth Mars Chronicles. Gerald, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm good, David. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor.
Tell us a little bit about Earth Mars Chronicles. What caused you to start that and to write this series?
Well, as I said in that short write-up on my past, that I grew up with a dream, and I found out as we tried to push the ideas of space colonization in the 70s that the bureaucracy and the people that ran the companies and so forth, they were politicians, they were business people, and I became a space-age dropout. But I always kept that kind of dream alive inside myself, and I watched closely as things unfolded over the last 40 years. And when I retired and I was looking around at something to do, because for me, retirement is just like changing careers, you know, except that I don't get paid as well. But the one thing that I knew I could do was put not just my ideas, but what kind of future I would hope would somehow evolve. I could put that down in the electronic media and in print, and perhaps get a dialogue started, just at least get some kind of a realistic look at what settling Mars would be like. It's always been a favorite theme of mine. But in doing it, I had to look at certain things. How would this come about? You know, what's the justification? Where do the resources come from? And all of that. So it took me down a very long path of research and thinking and iterating. And so it's something that I've been working on just almost full time for going on 4 years. And I've got the first 2 full books and 2 parts of the third one that are in place. But the series goes all the way from the thought process of creating a separate place for humanity to thrive, and also a place to preserve a large part of our civilization, as much of it as possible. So in the event that something happened, then we would at least have a branch of humanity still alive, and also we might be able to come back and kickstart civilization if we got kicked back 400 or 500 years and in some events. And so I took that as the basis, and interestingly enough, I wound up sort of modeling the events and the people around the what I call the Apollo model of what happened in bringing Apollo to fruition with the landing on the moon in 1969. So that's kind of the genesis of it.
Well, why Mars? Why do you pick Mars as where we should be headed?
Some of my good friends that were the devoted, you know, manufactured space colonist kind of folks always had the same question. And we had lots of late-night debates into colonizing planetary surfaces as opposed to building new worlds. And there's probably a place for both, but my conclusion was that the simplest and the easiest to sail was the planetary surface approach. And in looking around at the solar system, Mars has a lot of attributes. Even though it's a tenuous atmosphere, it does have an atmosphere. There are lots of resources that are readily available, especially water. It's not, there are things that we have to do to make it practical, but it's not especially difficult to get there and to get back. And so all those things taken together, I concluded that it was preferable over the moon, and it was the only other place to consider.
Do you think that most people yet, or now, I guess would be a better way to say, pay attention to the possibilities of a Mars settlement? Is that rising in a level of interest, not in the space world, but in the general population world? Do you think more and more people are getting interested in that as a goal?
My impression, and that's all I can give you, my impression is it's very minor. I don't see anything in, you know, my kinfolk and my extended friends in different areas. They're interested when we sit down and talk about it. The ones that read my books, you know, find it interesting. But if you were to lay down a set of priorities in front of them and, you know, ask them to choose, there are a few that would probably say, okay, we need to, you know, dedicate part of what we're doing to this. But you wouldn't find any kind of an overwhelming majority or, you know, any kind of a groundswell. I just don't see it.
Since you went to Auburn, my hunch is that more people would suggest Auburn be number one in football than care about going to Mars to live.
Right.
I mean,
well, we're happy we're number three right now.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying that rises. You know, Oklahoma football to me is like Auburn is to the people in Auburn, and you know, Mars doesn't even rise to the horizon compared to what's happening with football and sports. So.
Absolutely. I agree.
Know, so whether that's a take on our society or not, I can't tell you. But I don't know. Maybe some football team will get a logo for Mars and be called the Martians, and it'll rise in popularity.
Well, the only way I overcame that in the books, and I spent months and months cranking through a lot of different potential scenarios, but what I finally settled on to make the story rise and come together was a whole cloud of interstellar objects that come wandering through the solar system unexpected and pummel the Earth pretty bad. They're detected, they're defended against, loss of life is minimized. There's a large part of the story that centers around what we would call asteroid defense, basically, and what could be done in 1 year if we had 1 year's warning. And the work that I did, the career that I had in the ballistic missile defense arena, you know, really helped me a lot in that, and also in the space launch arena. But anyway, I just use that to kind of pound people into understanding that that life on Earth was in a very tenuous position, and that even that was on the verge of dying before some other events take place in the book, and I won't do a spoiler on that. But anyway, I came to the conclusion that it was going to take somebody just, you know, slapping the beans out of us to, in general, I say us, I mean, you know, the population in general, to get that kind of attention. So I took the easy way out, in a sense. I made people have to pay attention, you know.
You have an email question already from a listener, Perry, in Joplin, Missouri, who says that he's listening at work. And he said, when David introduced you, he said that you were an early supporter of Mars One. Does that mean that you want to go and live on Mars on a one-way mission? Are you ready to do that?
I would be ready to if I were the right age and the right amount of work went into the project to answer the issues. There are a lot of open issues, and I'm 70 and retired, so it's not an option, especially after you've had, you know, three bypasses and a valve replacement.
Yeah, but older folks are supposed to be more resistant to radiation, so you might be, because you're going to die anyway, so you might be a prime subject for going to Mars.
Well, that's one way to look at it. That's true. Hey, if I were in the right situation, I would definitely make a one-way trip, no question about it. Now, that's also based on having led a nice full life and traveled a lot and seen a lot of, enough of the Earth to feel like I've been there, done that, and, you know, I'm ready to go somewhere nobody's ever been before, and that sort of thing. But I think there's a lot of young people, and the reaction that they've had with Mars One, I think, underscores it, that there are a lot of young people that have a similar kind of emotion about it, that they really want to be somewhere that, you know, nobody's been in 4.5 billion years or whatever, and see things that nobody's seen before them, or if they have, there are probably only five of them, you know.
Do you think the Mars One approach is the way to go to settle Mars?
When you say the Mars One approach...
Well, you list a lot of different approaches in some of the material you've sent me.
Yeah.
So, different ways of doing it, like the Elon Musk model, the Mars One model, the Apollo,
right.
You know, the single. So there are different ways we could achieve Martian settlement, or at least an outpost or a colony on Mars. So the Mars One plan, whether it's enacted by Mars One or, you know, it could be some other group that survives Mars One and takes over. One way, going out there with resupply every 2 years or so, do you think that makes a lot of sense, including economic sense?
When we talk about economic sense...
Yeah, that's the butter.
Yeah, we have to go down a whole different path on that. In terms of just trading it off against other approaches, if it's expanded on, I think that there's a lot of potential there, because... they are attempting to do it as a non-national, worldwide involvement, kind of a project. And I'm personally convinced that it's going to have to be something like that before we're going to bring all the resources together. And I'm not talking about sending a team of 4 or 6 or 10 or even 12 people, on a one exploratory mission. We're talking about settlement, and that's the thing that I wanted to get into when I started writing these books, is I wanted to really take a good, hard look, in-depth look at what are the issues related to large-scale settlement of Mars, not just getting a few people there, not just doing boots and flags and, you know, that sort of thing and bring back a few rocks, but, I mean, actually starting a new branch of humanity on another planet. And when you... Now, look at the different models. That one, theirs is very appealing from that standpoint. I think that there's merit in looking for the entertainment part of it, because, you know, so much of our economy in this country and in Europe and, Australia and other places, too, that runs on entertainment. whether it's the NFL or whether it's NASCAR or whether it's television shows or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, entertainment is a huge economic factor in the Western world. And so, you know, tying that, I see some sense in that. Trying to make it a grassroots movement across the world, I see some sense in that. So they're, from that fundamental model, I like what they're doing. From the standpoint of creating an organization that's going to be able to pave the way through the maze of technological issues and the developments that are required and that sort of thing, I don't know. I've got an open mind about that. I personally think that the 10-year, 12-year threshold is not going to be achievable. But in terms of the model, as I just described it, you know, there's a lot of pieces to it that I do like. I don't think we've hit the right model yet. And found the right impetus for it. I think we're in a position where we've got to start thinking about 50 years at a time, not 10 years at a time. And one reason I say this is we got kind of spoiled, we got kind of misled by how quickly things happened. Well, let's just take this. From Dr. Von Braun and the folks in his rocket group in Germany before World War II, 1934, they launched, I believe there were two of them, I believe they launched their first two little rockets, liquid fuel rockets they'd put together, a lot of it based on Robert Goddard's work. And so 1934, their first two rockets they got off the ground, liquid fuel rockets. 35 years later, now just 35 years later, 1969, we landed on the moon. And you think about the incredible technological advances that had to take place in that 35 years, it's almost overwhelming. And a lot of that is because we had two wars. We had World War II and we had the Cold War. And all the military investment, when people talk about the money that's been expended, you know, for space efforts, I've never seen anything that really takes into, you know, everything from the entire military side, the top secret, the black world side, you know, everything as well as the civilian side, and put that all together. It'd be an overwhelming figure. And expecting that to happen again, I don't think is realistic. I think we really got to start thinking in terms of getting our technological issues solved, putting some system in place, some group of people, something. I don't know what it is. I can't tell you right now, but that says, okay, we've got 20 years to do the technologies and prove it to a readiness level of at least 7, meaning that it's, you know, in a prototype and in an operating environment, so that we have the issues of food, water, oxygen, radiation. We got a solution to all those things. We got something in place, and we really understand them. Right now, my impression, and I'm no expert in this stuff, my impression is that we got a lot of people grasping at straws, and we got a lot of people that are hanging on a few points of data because they happen to lean in their direction. And that's not just talking about those that are pro doing something, also those that are against doing something. You know, they're each hanging on a certain amount of data. And so that's just not right. And the whole question of the viability of pregnancy and child raising and all that sort of thing, you know, you can't expect a whole bunch of people to go to Mars and live there unless they can have kids and raise families. So you got to answer these things. And I don't think you can answer them in less than 20 years, to be perfectly honest with you.
Do you think we're moving toward answering those questions?
Well, it's a haphazard approach. if there is a concerted effort somewhere, I am not aware of it. I know, you know, NASA puts out broad agency announcements, and they come up with different programs. Different people within NASA do this, and they want to address different technical issues. But it's the issue du jour, you know. It's the whatever technology is getting the most publicity at the time, and that sort of thing. And so, as long as you got that kind of situation, and you don't have some kind of coordinated, concerted effort. And again, it's going to be pretty much going to have to be an international thing. I mean, people have got to swap data. They got to believe in each other's work. You know, they got to come to common and accepted conclusions. But I think all that's got to be done before we get down to that final design, that critical design review, you know, before we go off and start drilling holes and bending sheet metal.
So maybe you can explain this to me, because we hear that we're going to eventually put people on an asteroid. We're going to go to Mars around, 2030, something like that time frame. And yet this concerted effort to solve these basic problems that you mentioned, or to mitigate them, there isn't a concerted effort to working toward that. So how seriously can one take these claims that we're going to go to Mars by 2030 or we're going to do this or that, when there's nothing being done or very little being done, let's put it that way, to solve what needs to be done to get us there?
It's just the opiate of the masses. As a famous communist writer once said, it's the stuff to make everybody feel better. You know, you say things like that, but, you know, that I think I sent you a copy of out of the NASA History Office, Roger
Lanius's
work on Project Apollo, a retrospective analysis.
Yeah.
And he says, something most NASA officials did not understand at the time of the moon landing in 69, however, was that Apollo had not, emphasis on not, been conducted under normal political circumstances, and that the exceptional circumstances surrounding Apollo would never be repeated or not be repeated. And the Apollo decision was therefore an anomaly in the national decision-making process. And that's, he says that after going through the whole discussion about how personalities worked so hard to even carry Apollo through to success, because there were people that wanted to cancel it by the mid-60s and into the latter 60s already. And so there was a lot of political give and take that was going on in Washington just to keep it alive. And then, you know, once Apollo 11 happened, I know from personal discussions that there were people already over at NASA headquarters saying, okay, you know, we held up our part of the bargain, it's time for you to hold up yours, and, you know, how many more of these are you going to do before you stop doing it? So if you got a situation there where it just took tooth and nail to hold anything together for 8 years, and now we're got people making these proclamations about things that are going to happen, you know, in 2035. Yeah, I don't think so. We're going to go through, what, five more changes in president. And it's just baloney. That's all it is.
So that focuses on the private sector. Do you believe the private sector can reach TRL 7, technical readiness level 7, which you've said is what the minimum is needed in order to be able to manage a human mission to Mars and to establish settlement?
Yeah, they could if they had plenty of money. And the question is, where's that funding going to come from? I really applaud what Elon Musk has done. He is my new latest hero, and think his heart's in the right place, and he's going to do what he can. But it's, you know, the same old, same old. When you get down to trying to do an economic justification for these things, you just can't make the numbers work out. Now, if there was something, if we had figured out how to show the ancillary benefit, you know, we talked a lot over the years about the spinoffs from the space program, and it kind of got some bad press and a little bit of a bad rep, but in fact, it really is real. I mean, we did enjoy a lot of technical achievement we wouldn't have otherwise in a lot of fields. And if we figured out how spending a considerable amount of money on reproduction in 0.38 Earth gravity, which is gravity on the surface of Mars, and could show that had a huge benefit, you know, here on Earth, then you got something you can sell, because they say, well, okay, we can do both of these at the same time, because we're going to wind up with a product that has legs on it in the long run, and we're going to end up with a product that pays the bill in the short term. But we're not very good at doing that, and I'm not sure we're going to get any better.
June in Portland, Oregon, has a question for you and says, if we are going to make an effort to settle Mars, what do you think the size of the initial Martian settlement has to be in order to be viable?
There's a lot of... I've worked on that quite a bit. I researched it when I was working on the first book. And if you do, there's one pretty strong study out there that says if you do the best genetic screening possible and you have an appropriate mix of people based on that genetic screening, that you can have a viable gene pool with as few as 180 people. And some people have argued that should be lower, some higher. But if you make a mistake, you don't have to make a very big mistake, but if you make a mistake or two in there, then it turns out that number won't absorb the mistake. And then it starts to climb. And all I saw was disagreement. The more I researched it and looked into it, the more disagreement I saw. But it finally became a non-issue for my purposes, because I took as the guiding light or the guiding principle that you wanted to save sufficient numbers of people representing all the different races and ethnicities of the Earth, so that they each would have a choice in reestablishing that specific race or ethnicity. And so therefore that became the forcing factor in how many people that it was going to require to do that. And it turned out that was well over 10,000 people. And so, like I say, the gene pool thing kind of disappeared once I got off on that track.
Yet, using Mars One as an example, their initial group going to Mars is under a dozen people. So is that even viable for 2 years or 3 years?
Well, they got, four in each group.
Right.
So four, and then 2 years later, four more, and 2 years after that, four more. So
6 years, they get a dozen people if they all live.
And and you can't, if they're screened a certain way, then there are certain pairs that come out okay, and then you wait, for the next four, and then the next four, and the next four. But that's one of the downsides of that scenario or that model, is that it's so slow. I mean, it's not the buildup has got to ramp up exponentially at some point in time, or I'm not sure where it goes, to tell you the truth. And it, and in fact, I don't. Somebody could do the could run the numbers, do the study. You know, it might turn out that you cannot get viable that way because of the 2-year difference and the 4 added each time. But that, again, is not something I'm an expert in. I just did a little reading to, you know, try to figure out how to handle it in a novel.
And even if you could reproduce on Mars, I mean, you'd be, you know, years before your offspring, you know, can contribute a lot to the settlement. Even if we looked at the Old West and we had, you know, kids that were 10 and 11 years old working on the farms and ranches and plowing and doing things, you're still talking a decade or more, assuming they grow up and they can be healthy on Mars. And nobody's sure about that.
Well, we got to be sure. It's not going to happen if we're not going to be sure.
Yeah, today we're not sure. That's what I mean. I mean, I don't even know how you research that without going to Mars to do it. I mean, how do you even simulate that with pregnancy and children? I would not even know.
Well, the only, I haven't given that a lot of great deep thought, but the only thing that occurs to me is going to the centrifuge studies in orbit.
Yeah, so what are you going to put children in that? I mean, the ethics of doing some of that research, I think, would probably stop you from doing the research.
I
don't know. I just don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, it's possible that we're never going to do anything, you know.
Here's a couple of other questions from you. This is from Evan. And I don't remember where Evan is. He sent in some email questions before the show started. And he said, one of the things often mentioned on the space show is the Challenger, how hard it is to put large payloads on Mars. And Evan, that's not just mentioned on the space show. That's one of the little realities that nobody likes to deal with. How close to reality is the method that you use for getting big payloads onto Mars in the Earth-Mars Chronicles?
Well, I did quite a bit of work in reentry physics and materials for reentry systems and all at one time. And the ablative approach is a very, very crude way to do things. I understand why we did it and why they're wanting to do it again. But there are better, more sophisticated ways. And I think the inflatable heat shield work has the most promise to it, and I am not privy to the deep, dark details, but that's the approach that I used. But I only used the inflatable heat shields for the pathfinders that are they're the people that are going in 2 years ahead of the first settlers to do all the preparation and so forth. So that's why they're called pathfinders. But they go in with inflatable heat shields with heat dissipation capability, but they also kill off quite a bit of velocity. They're in orbit and then deorbit. So you're not trying to come from 7 to 8 kilometers per second, you know, into the atmosphere. You're coming into the atmosphere at less than 3 kilometers per second. So that's one thing. And then by the time the settlers were coming, I took some liberties, as is the right of all authors who create their own universe, and assumed a certain level of development and propulsion technologies and that sort of thing. And basically, I killed off all the orbital velocity with propulsion and then just used the inflatable as a drag device. And so the 3.2 kilometers per second of orbital velocity was killed off with propulsion, and then the drag device brought it, the payload, if you want to call it that, to a terminal velocity. And then that's all you had to deal with once you got down to a level landing. I don't know how deeply that's been looked into before. It's just something I thought of a long time ago, and I ran through some numbers and used the NASA standard atmosphere for Mars and looked at the size that'd be required for, you know, the inflatable drag device, and it didn't look particularly unreasonable. So that's what I did. How to measure that 40 years from now, you know, against where we are today, I don't know. But I think they're both doable.
Should we be in a hurry to get all of this done and to start a viable Mars settlement plan, given that many people, including, I guess, yourself, since you talked about it earlier, believe that we could be targeted by a big incoming rock that could, you know, destroy civilization it has, you know, before, or we could do something to really screw ourselves up. You know, we've done that too, but not on a planet-wide scale, but I guess we're capable of doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Should we be in a hurry, or can we just kind of take our time and fiddle around, you know, while many people think Rome is burning on several different levels here, which is kind of what I think we're doing now. We're fiddling around while, you know, we've got a really turbulent world on so many levels that it's not even funny.
Well, my impression, and, you know, you and I are not that far apart age-wise, as you increase in knowledge and insight and wisdom and stuff, you get a little more cynical, I guess. But
yeah, and decrepit with age, don't forget that.
Yeah, right. But anyway, I think that I get the feeling that we're on a walkway as a world, as humanity, as a civilization. We're on a walkway that has a precipice on each side, and the further we go, the closer the precipice on each side seems to be getting. And we are becoming very, very volatile, yes, but vulnerable. We're getting more and more vulnerable all the time. And you see discussions practically every week on, you know, electromagnetic pulse and the influences that, you know, a mass solar ejection can have, that nuclear weapons set off can have, that EMP weapons can have, and this sort of thing. And so there's a lot of vulnerabilities, as well as the fact that the Earth is still a very volatile planet, and we know someday that there are some, you know, massive events that are sitting around waiting to happen. The volcano out in Yellowstone being one. We have no idea, you know, when these things are going to happen. On a human scale, you could say, well, you know, gosh, we don't need to worry about that for the next 50 or 70 years. Well, if it takes 50 or 70 years to actually get to a point where we start to go down another path, you know, and build ourselves an alternate branch of humanity, then, okay, we can say, hopefully we roll in the dice, and that's not too big a chance. But how long do you put that off? I don't know. Nobody knows, and that's the problem.
So I'll go back to my question. Should we be in a hurry?
Well, using whose clock?
Let me rephrase it. Should we get maybe a little bit more serious and actually create a timeline with steps to take by certain intervals to bring about the reality of options, whatever those options society decides should be? Do you think we should be more serious about it and more planning about it, commit budgets to it, you know, that type of thing today, rather than just rhetoric?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of a why not thing. And if we have young people that feel the motivation that a lot of us did in the 50s and 60s, and they want to put their life's work into it, and somehow they can get some insight into these issues, and that's always part of the problem, you know, is transferring this this kind of knowledge and insight from one generation to the next and to the next. But I can imagine having a kind of a critical nucleus of people that evolve and come together, and they make that happen. Right now, there again is no, you know, no forcing function that's going to make people think that way, going to make people do things that are not on their radar. And I can't, what I wrestle with is, you know, how is it going to happen? Yes, I believe it should happen. Yeah, I think that there should be some kind of centralizing, organizing, putting, you know, allocating resources, putting priorities on things, you know, working on this 50-year plan. But I can't quite see how we do that unless we just get lucky again, like we did with Apollo.
Marilyn's in Tucson, and Marilyn says, if we actually had a settlement on Mars, whether it came from Mars One or some other organization, what kind of governments would it use? Has Mars One ever said how they intend to govern their Mars settlement? Also, how do they base an economy for their Mars settlement? Do they trade? Do they barter? Is everything free? What are their plans?
Well, I would, direct response, I would ask her to go to the Mars One website, mars-1.com, and look at some of the discussions there that they have about that. From a governance standpoint, there's not been a lot of work done on that, but it generally the feeling is, I think, that it's probably going to be left to, you know, the people that live there to decide, you know, what they need and how that needs to be done. When it's such a small number of people, there are not a whole lot of options that make any sense. You know, typically you're going to have some central leadership and a division of responsibilities. As far as, you know, the economics, it's whatever the income is from the entertainment value of watching people living on Mars, last I heard, but I'm not privy to, I do not speak for Mars One. Baz and Arno are not confiding in me, and I don't bug them about it. So, you know, what their latest thinking is, I really can't respond to that.
But even if they got revenues from entertainment, I mean, that's here on Earth. What do they do on Mars for an economy? Or have you thought about that in Earth Mars Chronicle?
Oh yeah, I develop in Volume 2 when they're actually building the settlements on Mars, and then going into Volume 3 where the economies evolve and on and on. I've given a tremendous amount of thought, and I've tried to evolve it based on historical precedents. We've tended to have in past exploration and expansion for humanity, we've tended to have a situation where things were supported initially, whether it was a king or queen providing the upfront money for a caravan or a bunch of ships, or whatever it was, or whether somebody put the money up to build a railroad, and that kind of thing. There was upfront money, but with an expectation of a very nice return. Now, in those days, they weren't looking at quick returns like we do now. They did think in terms of, you know, 5 years for when they'd see their money back and that sort of thing, because it took so long to for any of this to happen, and 3 years to 5 years. But what I did was because this alliance of nations is formed on the earth that work together to settle Mars, and they have a central governing body that they agree to and so forth, and the United States takes the technical lead on things. And so initially, the Earth is pumping resources into the Martian settlements until the point that those settlements achieve a self-sufficiency. And they achieve that by, you know, building up their own manufacturing capability and building up their own capability as far as, you know, growing their foods and raising the fish and eventually the animals that they start to bring in. You know, so it's a typical kind of thing that people have always done. And then you finally get to a point where there are, one thing I use that I leverage on is exploration, because I firmly believe that if you've got a crew on, or a pretty good sized group of people on Mars, and they've got the capability to travel, I use these things called hoppers. But if they've got the capability to travel, then one of the things that they can sell is exploration, because they're there, and they can sell a lot more data for an exploration at you know, a good price than anybody would ever get from sending a small robotic, you know, exploration vehicle up. So exploration becomes an export. And then other things. So, I come up with rare elements that start to become even more rare on Earth and a way to export those. And so you just kind of build this economy. But you also had to transition from this very large group of people that are getting certain things from Earth. Even when they get self-sufficient, there's still a lot of stuff they like to get from Earth, like really good beer, you know, and spirits and things like that. But there's a lot of things they would still want to get. But as they become more independent, then they have to develop their own economy, and so everybody has to agree to it. And so I kind of meld all that into things as I go and try to make it logical based on human experience.
You have a caller waiting on hold, and then we'll probably take our first break. So, hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug.
Hi. Just regarding the economic justification of Mars, Elon has been asked about this question, and for his company SpaceX, he's imagining that the way he would sustain himself economically is that people would sell their homes, their assets that they had made on Earth, and then they would pay him to transport them to Mars, and the market demand would basically be a demand of people who would like to go and live on Mars, such as retire on Mars. So the analogy that I'd make is near where I live in Southern California, there's a city called Sun City, and it is a retirement city. And if you went back 50 years ago, that city probably largely didn't exist. And yet there's been you know, a housing boom over the years because of people that have wanted to move and retire there. Now, because it's a retirement city, there's no really industry there, so the money, they're not really making a lot of money, but they have brought money that they've made in their, you know, in their working life into that city. So do you think that is a sort of an early term explanation for how financially it could be supported?
Well, that's one area where I've got a problem with Elon's model, because what you're doing then is you're saying that only the rich people can go to Mars, and you need a lot of us poor middle-class working folks to support a society. And so then you got to figure out, well, where do they come from? How do we have this this labor pool? And the easy answer is, oh, we'll just make a lot of robots. Well, it really doesn't work that way. And so I think that's a very difficult model to implement, and I also think it's got quite a few sociological and political implications to it that could be difficult, and that's probably a long, drawn-out discussion. One thing I did interesting in the books was I started out where, since this is a worldwide alliance of nations and everybody has an allocation of the number of people of their nationality that they can send and that sort of thing. Eventually, things are going to hell in a bucket on Earth, and food supplies are getting short and so forth, and so everybody starts bailing out of the alliance, and so finally they stop sending settlers to Mars, except now that things are really getting bad, the people that can buy their own way want to go. And so now only the rich can go to Mars, and that's in part 3 of volume 3. And so that's something I'm wrestling with right now, is what does it mean if you've got a society that has been built on people that are a real cross-section. Some are very well off. Some had little or nothing before they were selected by a very top-secret criteria to become settlers on Mars. And how are you going to infuse nothing but wealthy people that most of them have spent most of their life being wealthy, and now they're going out on the frontier, and it's not a slam dunk. I guarantee you that. And like I said, that gets into a philosophical discussion that pretty much beyond the scope of what we're talking about here.
Well, I mean, but we could get into the very same philosophical discussion about whether it's fair for only the rich people to buy a Virgin Galactic ticket to be able to experience space, and those of us who don't have that sort of money cannot afford to have that experience.
No, and I disagree with that. I don't think it's in the same ballpark.
Well, in terms of the amount of money?
No. On the one case, let me expand it a little bit. If you're going to make Mars attractive for people to sell everything they've got and go there and retire, then there has to have been a whole lot of work up front. I mean, the environment's got to be created that, you know, makes it a great place for them and everything. So, kind of by definition, you've got a fairly large workforce that's already had to settle Mars in order to create a settlement that is attractive to those who can pay their own way. So that, I think that's a major difference. And the other thing is that the going suborbital for a few minutes of weightlessness and seeing the curve of the Earth is a very transitory thing. It's not a life dedication, pioneering the frontier, going down in history, you know, kind of a thing. I just think they're kind of in two different camps. So that's where I'm coming from on that.
Okay, fair enough. I wanted to address, you mentioned about the viability of the gene pool. I think one needs to bear in mind that if one allows the inclusion of artificial insemination with frozen embryos, then it sort of completely changes the picture for the number of settlers that you need, because if the gene pool can always be, refreshed with totally new genes from embryos, then you could really start with a relatively small number of people And yet, there's really no limit in terms of the genetic diversity that you could have.
Yes, that's true. And I think that there are a number of different potential paths to address the childbearing and rearing, rather than, you know, strictly traditional, you know, get pregnant and have a kid kind of thing that, that we've had, you know, as the model on Earth forever and ever. And it may be that, you know, a different model works on Mars, and we need to find out what it is. And that's really more my message than to say we, you know, here's a bunch of parameters. We're going to stay within these parameters. Now let's figure out how to make this work. And, oh, if that doesn't work, then, you know, we're dead in the water. You know, let's look at alternatives. And the even if the children are born on Earth and grow here to a certain age, and then are taken to Mars by their parents or something like that, you know, I don't know. But there's a lot of things that would need to be looked at. It's not just a matter of waving your arms and, you know, making a pronouncement.
Right. Now, let me just ask sort of a big fundamental question. That is, I mean, given the NASA's LCROSS results of the moon showing that there's not only, you know, very large quantities of ice as well as carbon and nitrogen within that ice in decent amounts, why the focus on Mars? Why do so many people feel as though Mars is the place for colonization and something that's much closer, safer, less expensive doesn't enter into the equation?
Well, I like it because with the atmosphere, you actually have, you know, a little bit of dawn, a little bit of sunset. You got some color in the sky. You get some clouds every once in a while. You got water everywhere, practically. And there are probably some very deep glaciers that are buried in some very interesting areas. You don't have to be around the poles to try to find the water. And you can't walk in 1/6 G. And it looks like you probably can walk in 38% G. And it's just a variety of things. It's just so much better analog, you know, to Earth. It turns me on. You know, what can I say? Always has.
Yeah, I mean, would you agree that settling the moon would probably be less expensive than settling Mars initially?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know that anybody's taken a real hard look at that. Intuitively, you'd say, well, you know, it's so much closer and all that sort of thing, but I don't know. I don't know what the cost trade-off would be, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, you might want to look at that, in particular, the proximity of the moon to the markets. In other words, orbital markets could support development.
Well, but one thing I know you're... I do depend on in my scenarios that the near-Earth asteroids and the moon go into development, and there actually are mining colonies and stuff like that that I wind up with on the moon. And, in fact, they compete with each other, and I call them the roids and the lunatics. And they, you know, it... In fact, I don't think you can make economic sense out of any of it ever, you know, until you somehow exploit those resources. Because if you can do that, then you've heard this many times before. You don't have to haul all that propellant up off the Earth. You got the liquid, you know, got water. You can make hydrogen and oxygen, and you can get that off the moon, or you can get it off the asteroids, and if you got manufacturing capability, you can build certain kinds of things that probably eventually will make sense to build in space. And so there's a whole infrastructure that winds up being the optimum way to go, rather than, you know, just trying to throw everything off the surface of the earth. I don't think that's a, ever going to fly, if you'll pardon the pun.
I hear you. All right. Well, thanks for handling that question.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Yeah, thank you.
Gerald, we're going to take a break because we're way beyond the halfway point. So sit tight. Everybody, we'll be back with more in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody, to part two of our Monday Space Show program. We're talking to Gerald Driggers about Mars, settling on Mars, and related issues. We have caller Kirk from Trinidad on the telephone with us. Hi, Kirk. Nice to talk to you again.
Hello, David.
Go ahead with your question for Gerald.
Yeah, Gerald, is there a large online community of Mars One volunteers and supporters who interact socially on via the social media, and do you participate with them?
Not in depth. There is a Mars One forum, and they have a lot of different strings going on, and it's easy to join. And if you punch it into Google, you should find it pretty easy. And there's always a number of topics. Honestly, I haven't looked at them recently because I try to spend most of my time writing.
Okay.
But they do have that sort of thing going on.
Yeah. Do you have a sense from when you've been in touch with them whether most people seem to have the sort of a realistic view of the project like you seem to express, or are there a lot of true believers? I mean, believers not just in the values and the mission of the project, which a lot of people might be, but actually believing in the rather short-term time schedules that are being published.
I can
I
also
want to answer that very carefully.
I won't answer it carefully.
Anyway, it's well, I don't want to, certainly don't want to offend anybody, and I don't want to I don't want to discourage people either, because what needs to happen is an educational process. I think that there are a lot of people who, taking it all at face value, and they do probably because, you know, they want to. And I don't, like I said, I don't want to necessarily discourage that. I would like for people to understand that there's work to be done, and it's not clear right now how that work's going to be done.
Kirk, I've put Boss on the show three times, and he is a very, very good speaker. He is extremely well-informed, very nice gentleman. And though I don't believe in his project at all, I would absolutely welcome him and put him back on the show. He's one of the best masters of public relations and PR I've ever come across in the nearly 14 years of doing the space show. I've also had a lot of the people who have applied for Mars One and want to go to Mars One and send in their money and their videos and all of that kind of stuff. And they are really, really, really big-time true believers. Now, Boss and his team know the realities of going to Mars and keeping their timeline, but they also interpret data in a way that lets them believe that they can mitigate the problems and that their plan will deal with the problems successfully. Whereas if you talk to a group of aerospace engineers on, like, let's just pull up Jim Logan or John Juras, that Logan, of course, is an MD, they're going to tell you, or Dr. Rowe, for example, they're going to tell you what actually has to happen to mitigate microgravity, for example, to get rid of these effects that destroy the human body and atrophy muscles and do things like that. Mars One won't go down that road. They know this stuff exists, but they believe that what they're doing will fix it or will mitigate it, and that it will all be worked out in the bath, so to speak, by the time they get ready to go. The people who are really enthusiastic about it and wanting to go about it, they're just maybe excited about the idea, and they're true believers, and they just trust that all this stuff is going to happen and it'll be fine. So you have a mixture across the board. But Boss does know the issues. There's no doubt about that. You know, Gerald earlier in the show was talking about pregnancy. You know, Boss was talking on the show about pregnancy and said, you know, it won't be a problem, and we'll have medical facilities, and we'll be able to deal with pregnancy and all of this kind of stuff. And so I asked him, you know, well, how are you going to do that? You don't even know the effects of a fetus on microgravity and radiation and all of this. And he said, well, everybody's just going to have responsible sex. You know, we're here in Holland. We all know how to have responsible sex. And, you know, my response to him was, what rock do you live under? But that was his approach. And that's on one of the archive shows. So they're aware of the issues. How they choose to mitigate them is probably a little bit different than if you were talking to people involved in aerospace medical research, for example.
Do you or Gerald know how much of their plans are, whether it really all just comes from the top down, or whether the community via the forum helps to evolve their plans and carry them on?
It was top down.
It's top down, but he's got a lot of consultants that, you know, everything is outsourced to consultants and to companies that, you know, have agreed to provide life support and other information. So it's not just Boss and his team himself. He has a group of outsourced resources that are involved in the space world that do know this stuff, that are giving him advice. So, but it's top down. I think the forums are just there for people to go and discuss and to feel as if they're part of it all.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, from reading the recent MIT feasibility study, it looked like they were just doing their best to put together what they thought his system would be like based on short descriptions and the artist's conceptualizations. Does the project not release much in the way of detailed information in the engineering side?
Well, unfortunately, they don't have a whole lot of it.
They make, you know, I did the show, I don't know if you heard the show for 40 minutes on my Hotel Mars segment with the MIT team who did this, but they took the information off the Mars One website to the degree that it's available, and then Boss says they're using off-the-shelf technology that's already functioning on the space station. So then they looked at oxygen generation and other things that are on the space station, and what they say at Mars One doesn't match reality. And so And then Mars One has come back with retorts on all of that, and they kind of were going back and forth. But the guys who wrote the MIT thing are coming on for a full hour and a half, and they will interact with the space show audience, which is not what they do with the Hotel Mars audience. And that is later this month. And it's on the website newsletter schedule. I forget the date. But if you want to talk to the guys who wrote the MIT study, they're going to be on the show and try to call in at that time.
3 weeks from tomorrow, on the 25th.
Okay, so there you have it. I forgot the date. But, you know, they'll take your questions and comments, and we'll go at it. And you can ask them that specific question, because they tried their best to use Mars One technology based on the Mars One website and what Voss says. But we're sort of off topic from Gerald being the guest on the show, so I don't want to do a show on Mars One specifically. See, you shouldn't have put that in your bio, Gerald. That distracts everyone.
I'm still proud of it. You know, it's not that. anything that will kind of get some really attention and stir the pot. I think it's also really refreshing to hear someone who is a supporter of them and very enthusiastic of the message and the mission that they see, but also very realistic of the challenges that you had. I mean, when Gerald called in to the show as a guest caller a week or two ago, I remember you asking him what he thought the probabilities of success are, and he says, well, you know, somewhat less than 50%, but he's not saying how somewhat. And I thought it was a very refreshing view. So, Gerald, back to your book. You mentioned that you have the people entering Martian orbit prior to doing entry and landing. Do you utilize aerobraking, or pardon me, aerocapture in onto Mars?
No, I give them a lot of resources, and I give them a lot of on-orbit propellant supply and building of propellant tanks, and just basically give them some, you know, kick butt capability in their spaceship, and just go straight into orbit.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing your book. I saw they're available on Kindle, and I was buying the first couple chapters.
I'm sorry,
on Amazon.
Talking over you. What was that, Kurt?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was saying I'm looking forward to reading your books. I see that they are available for Kindles, and first couple chapters are available to view up on Amazon.
Right. Now I forgot where I was.
But I'm sorry.
You're talking about the books and the chapters available on Amazon.
Yeah, and Gerald, I don't know if you were talking about the propellant resources.
If you're given enough, let me back up. One of the things that I did for myself in creating my universe in which this occurs was I allocated plenty of resources, and there was no need to have serious concern about optimizing everything and using aero capture, entry at high velocities and everything. Just back up and say, how would I do this in a least risk, most straightforward fashion? You know, if I had the resources available to me, then how would I do it? And that's what I came up with. You know, which is different from saying I'm resource constrained. I gotta cut weight everywhere that I can. I've got to cut dollars everywhere that I can. I've got to make everything as light and small as I can, and all that sort of thing. If you start loosening up some of those constraints, then you get a different solution. That's what it boils down to.
I suppose that's why there's a lot of advocates really talking about cislunar space development, and Dr. Spudis is on the show talking about the great resources that can come from the ice on the moon, and that really may be the quickest way to Mars is exploiting the moon first.
Well, it may very well be. I don't know, you know, what's going to happen between the roids and the lunatics as far as you know, battling it out over providing propellant, but if you got a pretty big market, you'll probably have both of them in there You know, if you're using chemical propellant for tugs and doing all your Earth to lunar and Earth to asteroid and back and all that sort of thing, then that turns out to be a very big market for resources, and it might very well be that they just get into a bidding war, you know, between the asteroid supplies and the lunar supplies. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to happen?
A surplus of supplies, that would be nice. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good evening.
Thank you. Enjoy Trinidad.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to some of the emails that are piling up here. I've got three of them now. So the first one is from your niece, Christina. Having read all the Earth Mars Chronicle books thus far, it is both sci-fi and enjoyable as an interesting possible future. To answer some questions already asked, the books talk about how to start a viable settlement and how the economics work as settlements grow. Having read the books, I would, of course, love to ask what is going to happen next. Maybe Gerald can talk briefly of his overall goal in writing the books as both an enjoyable read, but also what he would like people to learn in reading them.
There's my niece putting me on the spot. She's a great editor, by the way. I want to give her credit while we're on the air here.
Is she a professional editor?
No, she's a lawyer.
Okay.
And she's just really good at it.
Okay.
I think it's the detail, you know, being detail-oriented kind of thing. The books are going to go full cycle. By the time I'm through the original mission of putting a separate nucleus of civilization way off to the side in order to assure continuity actually pays off. And that becomes very, very complicated. And I haven't begun work on that very last part of it. But, you know, what I'm hoping to show is that you go full cycle from a realization that here's something big and important that civilization, humanity as a whole, as an Earth planet species, not as a bunch of individual cliques and countries and religions and all that, but as a whole planet species, here's something that's really worth cooperating on and doing, and here's what the payoff from it could be if things go really bad. And kind of make it just, you know, come full circle. And I'm writing for people that have similar interests to enjoy it, but, you know, I'd hope that at some point in time in the future there would be people that read it and say, you know, this is a pretty good idea. Maybe we really should be figuring out how to cooperate, and maybe some subset of those people will turn out to be the ones that are in their teens or early 20s, and they kind of go off on their path in life, but they've always got that thing, you know, back in their mind somewhere, and an opportunity comes up that, you know, has some of the earmarks of how Apollo happened. You know, not the same way by any stretch, but just, you know, taking advantage of a set of circumstances to make something happen. And that's what Dr. Von Braun did and Sergei Korolev as far as in Russia. So that's kind of my, you know, hope for the books, is that it creates something that's realistic and worth looking into.
How many more will you be writing?
There's four volumes. Volume 1 and 2 are published. Volume 3 I broke down into three parts because it was beginning to take on Michener proportions. And so I've got Part 1 and Part 2 out, which are the turmoil part and then the independence. And I'm working on Part 3, which is where things really begin to break down on Earth. And things solidify on Mars, if you will. And then at the end of that, things will have really gone bad on Earth. And then the fourth book is going to be the reprieve. It's going to be the of how putting away this haven of civilization, not just haven of humanity, but haven of civilization, could come back to kickstart civilization again and drag it out of something that's where they've retrograded for 400 or 500 years, you know, and not have to take 400 or 500 years to get back to where we were, but, you know, some shorter period of time. So that's the general idea, subject to, you know, change as I work my way through it. So
okay, let me go to some of your other questions here. Tony says, will there be a spiritual component on Mars to grow a successful colony on Mars?
Well, the definition of spiritual component has to be a part of it. If the question is whether religions, you know, are alive and well, well, you know, my response to that, as shown in the book, is yes, they are, because you can't try to take little snapshots of every part of humanity and put it on another planet, you know, unless the individual religions are part of it. You know, so they have to make the transfer to the planets because they are individuals that want to do that. Now, at the same time, my folks put processes in place to try to weed out the you know, the fanatics and the evildoers in that. But if that's what he means by spiritual component, then yes. If spiritual component means something a lot more subliminal, then I guess the answer would be no. But it just depends on what the, you know, what he means by that.
Well, and then someone's going to have to define evildoer and fanatic, because the fanatic never thinks that they're a fanatic, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Moving right on through religion. to this one's going to be a little bit longer. So this is from Judith. I don't know where Judith is. Judith Amanda. I'm listening at work and missing some parts of the interview, so I hope I'm not repeating an already answered question. The main push for exploration used to be things like religious freedom and riches, but there did seem to be a larger desire to explore for the sake of finding something new. This day and age, exploration seems only possible through a life-threatening situation. Do you think one of the greatest blockades to exploration is entertainment? Movies and games used to inspire exploration, but now such entertainment tends to keep adults and kids inside instead of going outside to build their own rockets and forts. So glad I'm catching some of the interview, Amanda.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, it is, and she is. I can't tell you how many guests that I've had on that are around your age and my age, because we're 2 years apart, me being the younger one, of course.
Yeah.
And you know, they grew up building, you know, like Leonard David, the space journalist at space.com and Space, he always tells the story as a kid he built a cardboard rocket ship and used to hang out in it in his yard all the time. And I can't tell you how many others, you know, built rocket ships, you know, to the moon. And, you know, we went out and enacted, you know, Rocky Jones, Space Ranger, you know, and stuff like that in the yards. And,
yeah,
you know, because we didn't have games and things to simulate this and that, that kept us inside glued to a picture tube of some sort. And so now, you know, she's 100% right. We've got all these simulation models, and they do keep you glued inside. So is exploration changing because of that?
I don't think so. I think the fundamental, I think it's triggers think different things trigger different people and the desire to see what's over the hill kind of thing. And it, my hope is anyway, and I've seen a lot of indication of this. I had the great pleasure of hiring quite a few young engineers in my career, and other people too, but primarily the engineers. And some of them in the latter years, you know, they were very much wrapped up into the digital world and into the games and so forth, and into the computer graphics. And I really didn't see any lessening of their imagination or their desire to learn or their motivation or anything like that. I don't think that it's fundamentally doing away with something there. I think it's just a different set of triggers and a different environment that they're working in. I cut rockets out of cardboard because we didn't have the money to go out and buy, you know, the metal toys as they were back then from Japan, but the stamped out, you know, metal rockets and stuff. Replaced by the plastic ones later, you know. So I'd cut them out of cardboard and put fins on and all that sort of thing, so I could build my own space fleet. And I don't think it's fundamentally different from the kid that's sitting there doing the same thing on the computer. And you know, he's got a program where he can build a pretty sophisticated rocket, and he can you know, fly it from Earth to Mars, which there's programs out there like that. So I think all the spirit's there. It's just the tools and the motivations and the triggers are probably different.
And they're not getting the physical exercise doing it.
Well, that's a whole different issue.
That's true. I tend to agree with you, on that. Some of the skills you learn with the, simulations and the model building and, is far more than we learned with building cardboard rockets and in acting, you know, 1950s TV shows in the yard.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these guys now they'll sit behind a computer and they'll have to figure out the trades to make sure the rocket can fly.
Yep.
And we never even thought about anything like we didn't even know any of that existed, or they'll have a hypothetical orbital depot up there where they can plan to go over and refuel. I think they're probably more mentally challenged and maybe creative in that way and less physically challenged. Probably is the ultimate way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
What should we have talked about today that we have forgotten or omitted or have skipped over or that you wanted to be sure to bring to our attention? Because we're a little past the ending time of the show. So what else should we have talked about? What have I forgotten here?
I think we've pretty well touched on everything, David. I certainly had an opportunity to express, you know, my feelings about stuff, and I hope that excuse me, I'd like to see the books become popular. They're very inexpensively priced, and I'd like to see that from the standpoint of getting the concepts out there and getting people to thinking. You know, a little extra income in retirement's always nice, but that's not the motivation.
And they're on Amazon, right?
Yes, right. They're on Kindle.
And can you order them also from your website?
No. The paperbacks are available on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble. The e-books are just available on Amazon right now. But ordering off the website is a whole different can of worms. We gave up on that.
What is Butterscotch Dawn?
I took a little break from working on Volume 4, which is Homecoming for Humanity. The four volumes are Hope for Humanity, Home for Humanity, Haven, and then Homecoming. And I needed a break from that, and I took a break and wrote a relatively short book. I'd call it a novella. It's about 42,000-43,000 words. It takes place in the framework of the settlements and the society and everything that's created in the books, and the Earth Mars Chronicle books.
Uh-huh.
And it's the story of two explorers that are out on a polar mission to Uta Crater up at the North Pole, and things start to go wrong, and they've got to work their way back to their home settlement. And it's their story. There are some scenes and things that take place back at the, you know, at the settlements, but it's really a story of survival and how to piece things together. I had a certain little bit of inspiration from Andy Weir's The Martian, and I'm really looking forward to his show with you, by the way, next week.
Next week, that's right. Great book,
right.
And turning it into a movie, too.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not the same story by any stretch of the imagination, not meant to be, but it's a talk about survival in this very forbidding place called Mars, you know, where the planet's out to get you, you know, and you've got to figure out how to succumb to it. So
how not to be gotten, right?
Right, exactly.
And listeners, that's also on Amazon, so you can check that out there. Well, Gerald, we'll stay in touch, and it's been very interesting talking to you, and I appreciate your coming on the show, and I look forward to more of your books and your information. You keep us posted when you've got more material out there, okay?
Will do, David, and thank you so much for having me on. It's a great honor.
Okay, and I look forward to hearing from you again and talking to you again. Call us on open lines, and when you get some more of the books done, let us know, and we'll talk some more on the Space Show, okay?
Thank you very much.
Listeners, that's it. Remember, I'm not going to do a show tomorrow night. I actually want to watch the election returns. So, we'll see what happens. And then Wednesday, Hotel Mars, as Jeff Faust is talking about the orbital Antares, and Doug Messier is going to be talking about Virgin. We're pre-recording these shows, so you won't be able to hear them until Thursday morning on the Space Show website, unless you can listen to a live streaming station on Bachelor, but I don't know what time he will air our segments. And then regular Space Shows on Friday and Sunday. So thank you all for listening, and thanks again to Gerald Driggers and all of you. Everybody have a great week. Goodbye from the Space Show.